we have a captive tiger crisis in America. There are more tigers in backyards and basements and bathrooms in the United States than there are left in the wild in the entire world.
Hi, this is Elizabeth Novogratz. Welcome to Species Unite, the podcast where we talk to people who are fighting some of the hardest fights on Earth to stop the unnecessary suffering of animals. Today's conversation is with Dulciana Winders. Dulciana is an animal law attorney, scholar, and professor, and she might be one of the most informed people on the planet. For over a decade, she was vice president and deputy general counsel at the PETA Foundation, and she's recently accepted a new position at Lewis and Clark Law School.
I have just accepted a position to start and run the world's only animal law litigation clinic here at Lewis and Clark.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So tell us what that means.
That means that I will essentially be running a mini law firm with students as the lawyers here at Lewis and Clark, and that will give students amazing hands-on practice litigating cases for animals so that they can then go out in the world and be animal lawyers. And we will be focusing, for the first year at least, on farmed animal litigation specifically. Students will actually get to go into court. I'll be with them every step of the way, because part of the point of this is to cultivate our next generations of animal lawyers, but they will actually be practicing animal law.
Give us some examples of what you're going to be fighting for.
So at the most basic level, we will be fighting for the billions of animals raised for their flesh in this country who suffer horrifically in intensive confinement. How we're going to do that, how we're going to bring lawsuits, is not a straightforward question. Otherwise, we wouldn't be as far behind in protecting farm animals as we are. So I have my work cut out for me brainstorming and talking with others who've been working in this space. But I do have some ideas about some particularly state law avenues that we're going to explore, some novel litigation theories that we're going to bring on behalf of farmed animals. I don't think we'll be working much in the federal space because there is a total lack of federal laws to protect animals on farms, which is where they spend the majority of their lives.
Going up against the meat industry, it's enormous on so many levels, and it's seemingly impossible because it's so huge and there's so much protection against kind of the evil side of it.
Yeah, we absolutely have our work cut out for us. I mean, the law has been crafted to essentially make farmed animals invisible, and we need to remedy that. And so we have ag gag laws to protect against exposing what's going on farms.
Tell us a little bit about them, because I don't think a lot of people outside the animal rights world have ever even heard of them.
Yeah. So ag gag laws basically are written to prevent people from going undercover and exposing the horrific treatment of animals, as well as humans in many cases, on factory farms. I mean, the reason factory farms have persisted and gotten so bad is because the public doesn't know. The public cares about animals and doesn't want to support their outrageous abuse. So folks, including PETA and other groups, have been going undercover and exposing what's happening. And in reaction to that, states are starting to pass laws saying that it's illegal to gain employment to conduct undercover investigations. And we have successfully challenged a number of these laws on First Amendment grounds.
And there's still a lot of states that have them, right?
There are. We've knocked them down in three or four states, but then the states will come back. We just filed a lawsuit a few weeks ago against an ag gag 2.0 law, which is trying to craft itself around the emerging case law. So it's an ongoing battle, both on the legislative front and in the courtroom.
But so basically they say that no one can police us except ourselves. That's the legal stance they take.
That is the stance they take. And that's what they've been allowed to get away with by and large for so many years. But now that there are more undercover investigations and there's social media to help spread this footage, they're rightfully nervous.
Well, and there's also teams of young lawyers coming up.
Yeah.
Yes, this didn't
absolutely
really exist, what you're doing not that many years ago.
Right.
Animal law was not a thing.
Right. No, animal law is new and it's growing and it's not going away.
More and more law schools now offer animal law.
Yes, most law schools in the United States, as well as a lot of law schools internationally, offer animal law. And we're starting to see them offer not just a general animal law course, but more offering, you know, a farmed animal course or a clinic, or in the case of Lewis and Clark, two clinic options.
Which is huge.
Yes.
Delcy was also Harvard's first animal law fellow.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Harvard started the Animal Law and Policy Program a few years ago. As part of that program, they have a fellowship program. I was an academic fellow, so that gave me 2 years to really just focus on scholarship, on animal law scholarship, which was incredible. And I spent that focusing on tackling the U.S. Department of Agriculture's failure to do its job in protecting animals. And I was able to do that from Harvard with access to all of Harvard's amazing academic resources and amazing support.
That is so cool.
Yes, I feel very lucky.
You've taught at a lot of different universities.
I have, yes.
And you've also been working with PETA Foundation at the same time?
Yeah, so I've sort of been doing two jobs at once for many years. I've been practicing full-time and then teaching on the side where I can. And that's part of why this clinic is so amazing, because it's going to let me meld those two perfectly.
You're creating history. I mean, this is the first of the first.
Yeah, very exciting.
So before we get back to all this, I want to go back and talk about you and how you got here and how it started.
I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, not in a rural area, in the suburbs, but I did, through happenstance, end up with two baby piglets who I raised. I bottle fed. They slept next to my bed for a while, and then we had them in our backyard, and they were ultimately slaughtered. That was a big wake-up call. I did not see it coming. I was told that they got, quote, too big and therefore had to be slaughtered and eaten. And it just sent me on a pathway of reading everything I could about animals, animal rights, factory farming, you name it, whatever the library had.
And then you knew this was what you were doing.
Yeah, I basically went vegan immediately and became an advocate immediately. Right.
And you were pretty young.
Yeah, I was about 14 years old.
What books hit you the hardest?
Of course, Peter Singer's Animal Liberation.
Yes.
Of course. Animal Factories was a big one as well. I think those were the two that really hit me the hardest.
Then you went to college, and knowing you were going to go to law school, was that kind of the plan?
I did study legal studies in college, so I knew I had an interest in the law. I didn't know for sure that I was going to do law yet. But while I was in college, I did some independent study work with Donna Haraway, who's done some really important stuff on human-animal relationships. And I taught a seminar on factory farming and animal advocacy. Even then, I was engaged in the movement. I did an internship within Defense of Animals. I then took a few years off to just, after I graduated from undergrad, to figure out what the right pathway was for me. I determined that it would be law school.
Where'd you go to law school?
I went to New York University.
At the time, it really wasn't a thing to go to law school for animal law.
It wasn't. Lewis and Clark had some programming, and I thought I was very close to coming to Lewis and Clark because of that, and ultimately decided to go to NYU, in part because they didn't have anything, and I saw it as an opportunity to get something started at another school. The New York City Bar Association has an animal law committee that I was able to get involved in as a student, and I would say most of the jobs and opportunities I've had have somehow come from relationships that I made there as a student. I did some internships with different groups and organizations in law school. I clerked for a federal court of appeals judge for my first year after law school, and then I've practiced animal law ever since.
And now animal law has really become a thing. You're a pioneer.
I follow in the footsteps of other amazing people who laid the groundwork, so I'm very thankful for that, but I'm glad I'm able to stand on their shoulders.
Most of your work with PETA was...
Before going to PETA, I was involved in a big Endangered Species Act case against Ringling Brothers. So I was part of the trial team. We had a 6-week-long trial against Ringling Brothers. It was an intense experience. And I worked on some other elephant cases. So I had developed already at that point some expertise in captive wildlife and especially elephants and circuses. So when I came to PETA, it just made sense to plug me in there.
But what a huge moment to be part of the Ringling Brothers.
Absolutely. It's huge. I mean, the nice thing is that all these other dominoes are falling now that Ringling Brothers is gone. We've seen numerous other circuses either shutter or decide not to use wild animals or even any animals at all. So it's the beginning of the end.
When that was happening, were you all expecting like the result you got, or was it because there's been so many no's with all of these laws?
Yeah. So, I mean, the result of that lawsuit was frankly devastating. We lost on the basis that there was no standing for the former elephant handler, that the judge didn't believe that he actually cared about the elephants, which, you know, having known him, it was devastating. But so much evidence came out as a result of that trial, and they just couldn't withstand it. So we knew that sooner or later they were going to go down, whether it was because of the animal abuse, because the elephants had rampant tuberculosis, one way or another, they were going to go down. But they fought vigorously. It was very challenging.
And why did it shut them down completely?
They said, we only know what they've said because it was their choice at the end, because the USDA didn't do anything despite their more than 150 animal welfare violations and killing dozens of animals. So what they said is it was changing public opinion, that the public didn't support this anymore.
I've met a lot of people who are surprised that we still have elephants in circuses because people thought that was it.
That's one of the challenges that we faced. A lot of people, especially those in more urban areas, think, oh, you know, we don't have elephants in circuses anymore. Actually, at any given time, there are probably about a dozen elephants crisscrossing the U.S. being exploited for circuses, and we need to shut that down. And we will, but for those animals, we need to hurry. New York and Illinois have passed some important legislation to end animal acts. Now they're looking at broader legislation. PETA is sponsoring a bill in California that would ban animals in circuses. So it's, like I said, the dominoes are falling, and, you know, dozens of local jurisdictions have already banned it.
And then there's the other side, and I think you probably run into this all the time, of people who have no bad intentions and they're really good people. They just don't know what the negative side actually is.
That's why so much of our work is education. And whether you're talking about the circus or factory farming, we need to educate people because they are compassionate at their core and don't want to support these things. But we need to inform them about what's going on, which is why transparency is so important. And we also need to prevent them from being lied to. There are a lot of companies, whether it's circuses or meat companies, that are just blatantly lying to people.
One thing I was reading from one of your papers was tigers and tigers in captivity. Most people have no idea what's going on. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, we have a captive tiger crisis in America. There are more tigers in backyards and basements and bathrooms in the United States than there are left in the wild in the entire world, which is mind-blowing. And we don't even know how many there are because they're totally unregulated. Private ownership of tigers is not governed by federal law. Numerous states don't regulate it at all. So estimates vary from 5,000 to 15,000 tigers in the United States.
There's a lot in Texas, I hear.
Yes, Texas is particularly notorious. Several years ago, Texas did pass a law saying that the counties could and should regulate this issue. But what we found, PETA has been in contact with numerous counties, and they weren't even aware of this authority, let alone, you know, actually enforcing the law.
How does somebody get a tiger?
It's remarkably easy. You can get a tiger online. You can get a tiger through word of mouth. There's a constant influx of juvenile tigers needing homes because the USDA allows exhibitors to use them for photo ops and other tiger baby playtimes, as one defendant in one of PETA's lawsuits calls it. So you have a constant supply of baby tigers who are relatively, though not entirely, safe to handle. And as soon as they get too big, they're discarded onto the black market, the tiger trade, or just locked away in pens for the rest of their lives.
And so the tiger black market, who's involved in this and where do they end? They're in one bad place and then what's the second bad place?
So a lot of times they will end up as quote unquote pets and they'll end up in people's homes. And sometimes those people don't know how to handle them. So they will end up, I mean, we've seen them just released on occasion. Sometimes they will be sent to reputable sanctuaries. Sometimes they're just locked away and ignored for the rest of their lives.
Tell us about the decline.
A lot of people think, that must just be like clipping your fingernails or not. It couldn't be further from that. It's actually amputating up to the first knuckle on each joint. So it's a series of amputations on each paw. It's incredibly painful at the time as well as chronically. So oftentimes it will chronically injure these animals. It also affects their ability to engage in all of their most basic behaviors. It's also a misconception that it makes them safer to handle. There's a tiger sanctuary operator who was actually attacked last week by a tiger and sent to the hospital. The tiger had been declawed and was actually crippled somewhat as a result of that, but nevertheless was able to inflict pretty serious injuries.
Still had teeth.
Exactly. Exactly. Still an apex predator, no matter what you do.
And this is legal in lots of places in the U.S.
This is legal in many places. And there have been efforts for many years, and there's pending federal legislation that would address this, the Big Cat Safety Act. So we're hopeful that an end will be put to it. But really, an end needs to be put to the allowing exhibitors to exhibit these babies. Otherwise, they're going to continue to be born and need to go somewhere.
And I think what makes this more confusing for everybody is there's really good sanctuaries that take in these cats. And then there's all these other places that are also called sanctuary.
Right. There are places that are playing off of the fact that people want to do right. They want to be supporting reputable facilities for animals. So they use sanctuary, refuge, all of these terms, and it's not a regulated term. And we see a lot of really bad places using this. And people have no idea that they may actually still be involved in breeding or the pet trade or allowing photo ops.
How do people differentiate, or should they even?
Really, you don't need to go see animals, so you can just watch these amazing videos we have available now, which weren't available even a generation ago. So we have incredible opportunities now. So you don't need to go see an animal. If you're set on it, I would say go to sanctuaryfederation.org. That's the Global Federation of Animal Sanctuaries, or GFAS. That's the gold standard accrediting body.
That's what I want to talk about too, compliance and inspection and the Animal Welfare Act.
The Animal Welfare Act is our single most important federal law to protect animals. It was passed to ensure the humane care and treatment of animals used for research, for exhibition, and for the wholesale pet trade. And so if someone is engaging in those businesses with animals who happen to be covered by the law, because there are a lot who are carved out, they need to have a license and they need to be inspected for compliance with bare minimum welfare standards. Unfortunately, currently the Animal Welfare Act means virtually nothing for animals. It has never been meaningfully enforced. And that's not me saying that. The U.S. Department of Agriculture's own Office of Inspector General over and over again has issued formal audit reports saying that the Animal Welfare Act is not being enforced in a meaningful way. It's being enforced in a way that is treated as a, quote, cost of doing business. And unfortunately, in 2018, we saw the lowest enforcement ever. So enforcement has declined precipitously, despite the fact that it was never vigorous. So enforcement is a big, big problem, which makes transparency very important, because if the public at least knows what violations are occurring, we can step in and try and help those animals or try and not support those businesses that are violating the law, even if the USDA isn't going to take enforcement action. But if we don't have access to that information, we're extremely limited.
Which we don't.
February 3rd, 2017, thousands and thousands of Animal Welfare Act-related records that for many years had been available online suddenly disappeared with very little explanation. And although dribs and drabs of information have been reposted, the bulk of that information remains unavailable despite a series of lawsuits, pressure from Congress, pressure even from within industry that wants this information available.
When this happened, there was a big uproar all over the country. The people were aware, but the timing was when a lot of horrible things happened because of the Trump administration. Every day there was a new uproar.
Yep.
This one, unless you were directly involved in animal rights or at least cared about them, it kind of got blown over for a lot of people.
Yeah, and it's remained hard to sustain attention on it because so many horrible things are happening for animals and more generally.
And for humans.
And for humans under the current administration. So it's like, where do you even begin? And this is a project that I've focused on and made part of my life's work, both scholarship-wise, professionally, in my litigation. So I've sustained focus on this, but the world sort of has forgotten about it largely.
Give us some examples of what this meant for animals in research.
So it gets a little bit nuanced now with the information that's been restored. But what it meant is three categories of records were taken down. Inspection reports. So those show whenever the USDA conducts an inspection, were there any violations or non-compliances with the minimum standards of the Animal Welfare Act? Were there animals who didn't have drinkable water or weren't getting vet care despite injuries or sickness? It used to be you could go up, you could type the name of the facility in, look up if they had citations, decide if you want to support that business, for example. Enforcement actions were also available. So you could find out whether they had received a warning or been assessed a penalty. And then research facility annual reports, which show how many animals were used in research, of what type, dogs, primates, cats, guinea pigs, rabbits, et cetera. And importantly, how many of them had been subjected to unmitigated pain and distress and what the purported rationale for subjecting them to that without painkillers was. Some information has been restored. Those research facility annual reports are available, but they're not posting the explanation pages, which say why we think it was okay not to give painkillers to these animals. So they're posting incomplete reports now. Enforcement actions, they are not enforcing at all. And I met with the agency a few weeks ago and they said, no, we're not planning to post those. So our ongoing litigation is incredibly important for that, especially when you see an unprecedented decline in enforcement. It's important to see those records.
How is this okay? Who's saying this is okay? Who's benefiting? How does that work?
So who's benefiting are the industries that exploit animals and the facilities that exploit animals the worst, because the quote unquote good facilities like the AZA zoos have said, we want this information available because it's our license to operate. It's how we show the public that we're doing okay, that we're different from that roadside zoo down the road. So it's the roadside zoo, it's the circus, it's the research facility that's harming animals that's
sure,
being protected.
But how is the roadside zoo winning? Who's saying, oh, wait, let's let the roadside zoo win?
It's the USDA, and it's Sunny Perdue. It's Bernadette Juarez, who's in charge of the Animal Welfare Act. They have made very clear that they are about protecting industry. They refer to industry now as their customers, despite the fact that they're regulating them. They came out with a report a few weeks ago. 5-page report referred to their customers 19 times in those 5 pages and listed who the customers were. Our customers are exhibitors, dog breeders, research facilities. So their attitude is that they're there to serve the entities they're supposed to regulate and to protect them from public criticism. It's astounding.
It's astounding, unbelievable.
And it's a complete abdication of their responsibility.
It's similar to ag-gag laws, like nobody can know mm-hmm. what's happening.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all part of this general trend of industry trying to clamp down and protect the public from knowing because the public cares about animals and the government stepping in and helping them. It's appalling. We have our work cut out for us. PETA and myself and a coalition of others are plaintiffs in 2 lawsuits challenging the blackout and a series of related lawsuits. It just takes a long time. I mean, we've been litigating for more than 2 years now.
For now, at least, it's at a standstill. And the public, is it there's just too many crises happening at once?
Yeah, I think that's what it comes down to. I mean, there's a new crisis every day, and they're just piling up, and it's hard to stay on top of everything.
There was public outrage when this first happened.
There was.
Now it's kind of just died out.
Yeah. I mean, the public is still very much aware of it.
Sure.
Certain sectors of the public, including state and local officials who rely on this information to enforce their own laws, and now their hands are tied. And that's why we need to be out there monitoring, and we need to be bringing, whether it's Endangered Species Act lawsuits, whatever avenues we can find to advocate for those animals, we need to do it because the USDA is not doing its job. So for many years, the USDA has engaged in a policy of automatically renewing licenses despite ongoing violations. And I've been involved in a series of lawsuits challenging this. One of my pieces that I worked on at Harvard focused on this issue. And so finally, the USDA said, okay, fine, we're gonna consider getting rid of automatic license renewal, rubber stamping.
Tell us what automatic license renewal meant.
Automatic license renewal means that if you send in an application to renew your license to exhibit animals or to breed animals for the pet trade, the USDA will automatically approve it. And they admit that this is their policy. No matter what, even if you're under investigation, even if an inspector was out the day before and documented dead animals on your property, dozens of animals in need of vet care, no matter how bad it was, they will automatically renew your license. They say that's an automatic administrative process. And our position is the Animal Welfare Act says you can't get a license unless you, quote, demonstrate compliance with the minimum standards of the Animal Welfare Act. So that's illegal. For years, the USDA has pushed to be able to get away with this. The DC Circuit actually had a good decision that said you can't keep doing it this way. And so finally, the agency said, okay, we think we're going to get rid of automatic license renewal. But they slipped in a provision saying that we're going to give everyone a right to a hearing and they get to keep their license. So if we decide not to renew their license, they can ask for a whole trial type hearing and keep their license.
How do you guys ever win anything?
Persistence, extreme persistence, and knowing that we're right. It takes a tremendous amount of patience and persistence. I mean, it could be so easy to just throw your hands up and say, you know what, I'm done.
It's insanity.
It's insanity. And it's like every time you think you've made a step forward, like the license renewal issue, it's like they found some way to backdoor in a way to undermine it. So we just have to be vigilant. And I just think of the more than 2 million animals who are supposed to be regulated under this law are counting on us to hold the agency accountable.
The public awareness has just got to play a bigger and bigger role in terms of...
Absolutely.
What is the public's best way of helping?
There are a number of ways the public can be involved. I mean, one is just voting because that's going to help with all of this. We need people in place who are going to pass good laws and enforce those laws because you can have good laws and then they just go on unenforced.
Part of me feels like, and it's true, animal laws and animal rights have come an enormous way in the past 50 years. But it still seems, when you actually talk to someone like you and hear what you're really up against, it's like the tobacco industry in the 70s.
It is. It really is. And we have a lot of work to do, but we have come so far. And there, I think we would be, I mean, I think there are a lot of things that we've just stalled and kept from happening. We could be in such a worse position if we hadn't been doing this work for all these years. So, and we need to remember the victories and build
those.
There's
been a ton of huge victories.
Absolutely. I mean, almost every day there's something new, whether it's in the legal realm or the corporate realm, which is another area where people can make a huge difference just through their purchasing decisions.
I'm excited for your new clinic. It's like you're developing a team of superheroes.
Exactly.
Right,
I'm to just going to send out them the out in the world and go do your work.
Make big change.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thanks for coming here.
Okay, thank you. We have a lot of work to do as a country when it comes to the way that we treat our animals. If you were inspired by Delciana and her story and want to find out more about what she's doing, check out her page on our website. It's speciesunite.com. We're also on Facebook and Instagram at speciesunite, and we're on Patreon. So if you feel so inclined to support the podcast, it'd be greatly appreciated. It's patreon.com/speciesunite. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please subscribe, rate, and review because it helps other people find our page. Thanks so much for listening to Species Unite. I would like to thank everyone who made today's episode possible, including Gary Knudsen, Natalie Martin, Anna Kollner, and a special thanks to Allison Berenger. Thanks again. Have a wonderful day.